So we're going to be taking up some light issues this morning. So, first off, I just want to say, I'm coming from Madison, Wisconsin, which is occupied Ho-Chunk land, where the Four Lakes region, if you've been in Madison, was known as Dejope in time immemorial. I also, before I get started, want to say, we'd like to recognize and acknowledge that we are in occupied lands of the Three Fires Confederacy of the Ojibwe, Ottawa, and Potawatomi, the original keepers of this land who were forcibly removed for the founding of the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. And we honor the Ojibwe, Ottawa, and Potawatomi that are still here and throughout the Midwest and so-called Canada. We also recognize the nations that lived in and around Illinois and the at least 75,000 indigenous people that live here today. This country was founded on stolen land, which we'll talk about today, and we stand in solidarity with all indigenous people in their ongoing struggle for self-determination and liberation. That's important. That's important for us to do that at meetings and everything like that, and we're going to talk more about that, how we shouldn't just pay lip service but actually do something. So I guess to start out quickly, Roxane Dunbar Ortiz, in her book Indigenous People and Indigenous People's History of the United States, said everything in U.S. history is about the land, who oversaw and cultivated it, fished its waters, maintained its wildlife, who invaded and stole it, how it became a commodity or real estate, broken into pieces to be bought and sold on the market. So obviously yesterday was 4th of July. It's one of the many myths of the United States, how we're the land of the free and home of the brave. And as socialists and radicals, we must understand the amount of blood it took to build this country. However, many still hold on to these myths, both conservative and liberal, and even some socialists, to this myth of settler democracy and the quote-unquote well-intentioned constitution. And we need to be clear that the foundations are rotten to its core. And even the documents that say quote-unquote nice things like all men are created equal need to be challenged to the core, and that they're absolutely despicable. So moving forward, there's some assumptions that I'm going to have here that we're going to go through. How the United States was founded on white supremacy, this ideology that white people were superior to non-whites. Settler colonialism, which we're going to talk about in more detail, specifically invasion and the use of settlers. Slavery, a slave economy, and we need to understand, obviously we talk about African slavery a lot, stolen people to work on stolen land, but also indigenous people were enslaved as well, a little known history in this country. And then the development of capitalism, and then imperialism is what Lenin called the highest form of capitalism. And I'm going to talk more about how these are all interrelated and were necessary to the development of capitalism in the United States. And since it is the 4th of July, I'm going to start with the settler colonial foundations of how a U.S. territory becomes a state. So the Congress of the Confederation of the United States in 1787, before the Constitution was written, passed the Northwest Ordinance. This was later confirmed with the Constitution. So following the Revolutionary War, which was fought not over independence from Britain, but over expansion of the colonies where the British Empire didn't allow settlers to move west of the Appalachian Mountains for fear of conflict between indigenous peoples and settlers. The young republic wanted to move west, and after the war created this Northwest Ordinance, which includes modern-day Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and parts of Minnesota. And this laid the very foundations for the pathway of statehood, which required settlement of the areas of people of European descent. So just to kind of go into the details of what it said. It said, first off, can only be no less than three states, no more than five. That silly stuff. But there's a three-stage process to become a state. So one, first you'd be with a congressionally appointed governor, a secretary, and three judges to rule in the first stage. Then the second stage, an elected assembly. One non-voting delegate in Congress. We still see this today with Puerto Rico, District of Columbia, Guam, and the other imperial entities of the United States. And when the population of the territory reached 5,000 free male inhabitants of full age, i.e. white men, and a state constitution to be drafted and membership of the union to be requested in the third phase, it was when the population hit 60,000. So this lays the foundations for actual, like, the United States that needed settlement in order for these states to become, these territories to become states. So that's really important and often, you know, unknown. Like, my students are like, what? That's how it's, like, the process to become a state. And it's also important to note that in the past there were states that applied for statehood that would have been like a Native American, the state of Sequoia, which was rejected by Congress, needs to be highlighted. So though the colonies were already engaged in settler colonialism through the British Empire, this laid the foundations and created a framework for the coming centuries of settler invasion for the American Republic. And we fast forward to today. We see the missing and murdered women and girls in Two-Spirited Movement, where a study recently in Canada was released that showed it was an epidemic up to genocide, and that is still happening today. We see indigenous people on the border being caged over an imperial border that didn't exist before the United States. Throughout history, this string of settler colonialism is continued and connects all this. So the years in between now and important policies like the Northwest Ordinance, settler colonialism has been embedded in every part of society on Turtle Island and is an ongoing process. So in this talk, I will argue that first, that settler colonialism, capitalism, and imperialism are interconnected in the North American experience. And you can't have one without the other. And they are all part of an ongoing process. It just didn't end at some undetermined time. And until the United States has fundamentally changed, we are still living in a settler colony. And I'll kind of demonstrate how settler colonialism is and was vital to the development and maintaining capitalism on Turtle Island by using historical examples, and I will show its connection to capitalism and how settler colonialism was and still is used to accumulate capital and develop in the development of North American capitalism. So understanding the history and ongoing process of settler colonialism adds to our understanding of capitalism instead of detracting from our understanding. Not talking about the colonial settler project adds to the erasure of Native people and the resistance to this very process. Now, I'll also briefly take up the usage of the word settler. You know, what does that mean? Is it useful for our movements for liberation? More importantly, do settlers on Turtle Island have an economic or political interest in maintaining settler colonialism? And the answer is like yes and no. And so we'll kind of talk about the complexities of that. So before I get into a little bit more of the meat of this, so some notes on language. I will do my best to use actual indigenous nations, such as the Lakota, Dakota, or Nakota, or the Esheti Sekoi, or the Ojibwe, the Anishinaabe, or the Dene, or Navajo. But I will interchangeably use words such as indigenous, native, Native American, American Indian, and Indian when it's appropriate or quotes are used. And when I use the word Turtle Island, which I've already used, I'll be referring to North America, which is the common name among indigenous people today. And I will be kind of lumping U.S. and Canada together because they have a similar experience in the settler colonial project. So to jump in about like socialism and colonialism, Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto in 1848 said, quote, "The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the entire surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, and establish connections everywhere." This sets the foundations of colonialism in all its forms, which laid the foundations for capitalist accumulation. And there were very different ways to colonize. There were outpost colonialism, or there's settler colonialism, which obviously we'll talk more about today, which were features of the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Israel, and we could list a few more. And Marx called this primitive accumulation, which is a word I personally hate, and is better translated into primary accumulation or original accumulation, which is the word I will use, unless it's in a quote. So Glenn Coulthard, who is Yellowknife's Dene, which is in northern Canada, in his book Red Skins, White Mask, Rejecting the Colonial Politics of Recognition, said, "Marx most thoroughly links the totalitizing power of capital with that of colonialism by the way of this theory of primitive accumulation. It was the horrific process that opened up what were once collectively held territories and resources to privatization, dispossession, and enclosure, which over time came to produce a class of workers or proletarianization. The historical process of primitive accumulation thus refers to the violent transformation of non-capitalist forms of life into capitalist ones." That totalitizing power of capital in the North American context required settlers and settler colonialism to strive to overturn indigenous modes of production and relationship to the land and supplant it with capitalist markets. Previous to capitalist markets on Turtle Island, most indigenous people did not have private property. So I want to take a quick note that there are hundreds of indigenous nations that are still here today, but also different modes of relationships, different governments, different social structures. But one thing that is key is that most did not have private property at all, which is the cornerstone of capitalism. Land was held in common, and there were different modes of relationship rather than ones of alienation, as Marx discussed in referencing humans being alienated both from their labor and land. Many indigenous theorists focus on modes of relationships rather than production. Colonialism brings individualism. Indigenous nations relied on interdependence in what Winona LaDuke, who is from the White Earth Nation in northern Minnesota, called co-evolution with their environment and surroundings. That was a sustainable way of life, and this isn't just coming from some mystical, noble indigenous person. Rather, the material conditions required nations to develop relationships with human and non-human life in order to live, and how we should strive for today. And many consider these societies of many indigenous nations to be communistic, pre-capitalist, and Marx started to actually write about this later in his writings. From the indigenous perspective, colonialism transforms abundance to scarcity while providing abundance to the settler states. Mm-hmm. The fundamental difference between the perspective of the capitalist and the settler state and indigenous nations was the latter had the view of interdependence with no private property. This inevitably created conflict that is based on these differences, since the former is dependent on exploitation, expropriation, and extraction. So I'll highlight later, but the process is actually never fully complete because of resistance. The U.S. settler state was not always successful, and it took wars and years of resistance. Now, we can just highlight a few, where the Seminole Wars in Florida were 20 plus years to remove some Seminoles. There's still Seminoles that are still in Florida. The wars on the plains at the Battle of Greasy Grass or Little Bighorn, where the U.S. faced the largest military defeat until Vietnam. The wars in the Southwest, where the Pueblo kicked out the Spanish in 1680 for 7 years. And the list could go on and on. And on Turtle Island, settlers were used to overturn the existing order of indigenous people into further development of capitalism. The United States was developed to represent settlers and capital, not indigenous people. So it is not unheard of us to say that the United States or Canada are settler republics. settlers were on the front lines of what was called an expanding frontier or an expanding empire. This isn't to say that capital was fulfilling the wish of every settler. Rather, settlers were foot soldiers and are foot soldiers in the American and Canadian project. This isn't to say that settlers didn't have an interest in this at the time, and we'll detail that a little bit, and they would get a piece of the pie, but the majority, you know, we're starting to see taken away to this day. So we're going to, you know, get into what actually settler colonialism is. Now, I've put a lot out there to chew already, and as an educator, I don't want to just speak at you, so I want to let you digest a little bit, so I'm going to give you guys 1 minute to just turn to someone next to you, or maybe three of you, and just kind of talk on what you think settler colonialism is, and what you think a settler is. So I'm going to have a timer here, so I'm going to give you guys 1 minute, so start percolating here. They are ready.
This is great too, because then you get to drink some water.
What?
It's great because you get to drink some water.
Yeah. Settler colonialism has become more and more of a popular term used in activist circles, especially when we talk in relation to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, or, you know, obviously the apartheid South Africa. But let's break down in a very basic way. You know, you can Google settler, and this is what comes up immediately: a person who moved with a group of others to live in a new country or area. And the same Google search will tell you colonialism is the policy or practice of acquiring full or partial political control over another country, occupying it with settlers and exploiting it economically. So I'm going to quote Nick Estes, who is Kiel Wishkasha, who is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux tribe and a co-founder of the Red Nation, which is a Native liberation group. He, in his book, Our History is the Future, kind of put a pretty good definition, I thought, of all the definitions you see out there of settler colonialism. He said, quote, "It's the specific form of colonialism whereby an imperial power seizes native territory, eliminates the original people by force, and resettles the land with a foreign invading population. Unlike other forms of colonialism, in which the colonizers rule from afar and sometimes leave, settler colonialism attempts to permanently and completely replace natives with a settler population. This process is never complete, and the colonial state's methods for gaining access to new territories change over time, evolving from a program of outright extermination to one of making indigenous peoples racial minorities and domestic dependent nations with their own land with their own lands and of sacrificing indigenous lands for resource extraction. So let's like break this down for a second. So in 1871, the U.S. stopped making treaties with indigenous nations. They unilaterally said, we're not going to have any more treaties with you. This essentially brings them into a fold of possibly, you know, a racial minority. And it wasn't until 1924 did natives become actual citizens of the United States. And Indian reservations today, you know, they have a trust relationship. So when we talk about domestic dependent nations, this is actually a word that was used in a Supreme Court ruling in relation to the Cherokee and their possible removal, that indigenous people are domestic dependent. So not fully sovereign nations, but depend on the United States. So today there's a trust relationship with indigenous nations where the United States still has a lot of control. So when we talk about sovereignty for indigenous nations today, in the framework of the United States, it's actually quite limiting, and we need to think more liberatory. And we'll talk more and more about some of these other acts like the Dawes Act, but you know, one thing to understand is that when he talks about sacrificing indigenous land, you know, uranium mining was big on the Navajo Nation. And those miners who were Navajo that were kind of driven by the Cold War thrust for nuclear weapons were extracting uranium. 1 in 4 got cancer. And I'll guarantee you, the United States did not give a shit about that. And 2/3 of uranium and 1/3 of low sulfur coal, as well as major hydraulic oil and natural gas reserves, are located in indigenous communities. So this definition, to me, is very important to understand the debate on the left on whether the United States is still a settler colony or not. So some theorists put forward the idea that a settler colony is simply a system where the non-native population has an interest in displacing indigenous people. They have no interest in standing up for indigenous rights. This is without a doubt true for the United States throughout much of its existence. In, you know, the mid to late 1800s, you would not see settlers on the frontier saying, yeah, we're going to fight for indigenous rights. No, they were on the front lines of fighting the Indian Wars. And this was exemplified by a piece of legislation, which I'll talk about later, like the Homestead Act or the Dawes Act. Kind of comparing this to Israel, there was a good article in the International Socialist Review that was What's the Matter with the Israeli Working Class, which kind of talks about how the Israeli working class does not have an interest in Palestinian liberation because they actually systematically benefit from the displacement of Palestinians, which is undoubtedly true in the current state of Israel and its Zionist ideology. But when Estes looked at settler colonialism, it's more nuanced, in my opinion, in the way that it's interconnected to capitalism and changes throughout history, using the word settlers that could be an individual person benefiting from the displacement of indigenous people in the mid-1800s or even today, or a corporation like Energy Transfer Partners, which is pushing through the Dakota Access Pipeline. So I see this framework as complementary to Marx's analysis of capitalism. And Estes, in his books, actually details examples of settler colonialism and what it looks like in the modern era. You know, specifically, he covers the development of the Pick Sloan Act that built 6 dams on the Missouri River between 1946 and 1966. This project flooded many indigenous nations throughout the river, and they strategically were placed right where indigenous nations were. And this was without a doubt without their consent, and displaced many indigenous people. And specifically, Estes talks about the Ohi Dam, which created the Ohi Lake, where the Battle at Standing Rock happened. And when that dam was built, it was the most destructive and destroyed 160,889 acres of Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Reservation land. So post-World War II growth gave the demand for extraction and energy policies like this. And these infrastructure projects were connected to the newly established termination policy, which was aimed to force indigenous people off reservations into cities to, quote, the total liquidation of indigenous political authority. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs argued how the flooding of indigenous land would speed up termination and force indigenous people into the capitalist economy. And this They said that this would, quote, force Indians into seeking cash incomes to make up for the substantial portion of income now represented in their use of natural resources of their present environment. So this cash income would be necessary since the Missouri River Basin investigation, which was a two-year fact-finding mission in 1946, stated that most indigenous communities on the river relied on the, quote, free goods of nature, such as hunting and trapping and gathering. This is what Estes means by the ongoing settler colonial project. And as Estes says, the process is never complete, and the struggle continues today as the project of stealing indigenous land is fundamental to the United States as its continued growth and success. Settler colonialism and its ideological companion of manifest destiny are baked into the development of the United States, much like slavery and racism, and cannot be extracted without completely overhauling the entire system. And land is still taken, and treaties are still violated today. But also, the capitalist settler state has met resistance every step of the way. We currently see in the Supreme Court, there is a Supreme Court hearing that could decide that half of Oklahoma actually is indigenous land, which we know that without the Supreme Court saying it, but that's an important struggle. The struggle at Bears Ears that Trump has retracted a lot of protection, which a lot of indigenous people fought. And it wasn't until 1978 that indigenous people even legally were allowed to speak their languages or practice their culture, and that's not that long ago. It was in the late 1980s in northern Wisconsin, where I'm from, where you see signs that say "Save an Indian spear under save a wall, I spear an Indian," because they were implementing treaty rights that the Ojibwe have under treaties. The Menominee in northern Wisconsin also fought to get the reservation back that was liquidated and terminated during the termination policies in the 50s. So this project is still happening. This is not something that's just in the past. Settler colonialism is a systematic relationship between capital, settlers, and indigenous population that is not just a relationship where settlers are racist and hate indigenous people, which is absolutely true throughout much of the United States history. But as Marx said, the ruling ideas are the ruling idea of the ideas of the ruling class. And the ideas that promoted settlers to organize themselves westward were driven by northern capital that benefited from the railroads cutting through indigenous nations and creating settlements. This is what we as socialists need to focus on. This brings me to my point about settlers. The lasting legacy of myths such as Manifest Destiny that glosses over the violent history while standing for a pledge or idolizing founding fathers, the Constitution, other deities like this, constantly promote erasure. Actually, this morning I saw like a Jacobin article that was like a left defense of Alexander Hamilton, who's an imperialist piece of shit. Not bashing Jacobin. Jacobin has a lot of good discussion, but that article just like, first thing I saw at 5 o'clock this morning. And these ideas are still discussed in our schools today. These ideological components lead to the justification for imperialist wars and continued violation of treaties. So to kind of talk a little bit more about like settlers and you know its interconnectedness with capitalism and imperialism, my ideas personally have evolved over time and are still evolving. And I think this is a debate and a discussion that is still happening because this idea do settlers benefit from settler colonialism today, and I think the evolution of settlers, as I've already mentioned, has happened in the United States. And I do think white people get really defensive on saying someone says, "Yo, you're a settler." It's like, don't be that white guy. It's like, "Yeah, I'm not a settler. It wasn't me." It's like, it's okay. This is part of the history. And in my opinion, there is an element of choice involved in this too. You can adhere to the settler ideology of conquest, or you can say, "No, I'm going to fight for liberation." And I think that's important. And natives do not have that choice. They do not have that choice. So oftentimes, when we discuss the European settlement and displacement of indigenous population of what is known as the United States, we use the word expansion, which is highly problematic. And in reality, we should use the word invasion, occupation, and genocide. These are more useful terms because expansion leads us to believe that there was nothing there. And it just like expanded out. And yes, it expanded out through invasion, occupation, and genocide, and resistance. This expansion or invasion was what the bloody process that Glenn Coulthard mentioned earlier. And when we use the word invasion, we can see how settler colonialism on Turtle Island quickly becomes overseas imperialism. Mm-hmm. They are one and the same, and they grow out of each other. Settler colonialism is actually imperialism, is continental imperialism, and that's how we should think about it, and how settler colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism have a dialectical relationship in on Turtle Island. So the process of clearing the way for settlers was not on the own dime of settlers. It was the United States Army and their forts and the development that were developed deep into Indian country that gave protection to settlers that were paired with important pieces of legislation such as the Homestead Act in 1862 and the Pacific Railroad Act in 1862. So Manu Kurunga, from his book Empire Tracks, Indigenous Nations, Chinese Workers, and the Transcontinental Railroad, discusses this dynamic, saying the army posts opened up Indian country which was, quote, created in order to serve to protect colonizers from indigenous people. The infrastructure of war and occupation actually establishes preconditions for settlement. So 1862, the Homestead Act, this essentially, gave settlers, could claim 160 acres of surveyed government land, Indian land. You could basically have it after 5 years of on the land and basically barely have to pay for it. And yes, there are some loopholes, corporations got these, but individual settlers did get these. And it's also important to note, like even if today companies are gobbling up some of that land, those settlers still got wealth out of that because they got money in exchange for a lot of that land. So that needs to be important when we talk about the wealth gap. And also, this is honestly the very definition of settler colonialism, and this was a major platform of the Republican Party, Lincoln's Republican Party. When they're basically, we need people to expand the free soilers, they called them. So that's really important. This was also 1862, the same year as the Dakota Uprising in what is called Minnesota today, where Lincoln oversaw the hanging of 38 Dakota warriors who fought against settlement there, and it was the largest mass execution in U.S. history. And this isn't to give Lincoln any credit, but the settlers wanted to hang 300 of them. So this is the dynamic and the violence that is happening. And this is during the Civil War. You have to think about it. There's a fight between the North and the South at the exact same time. I already mentioned the Battle of Greasy Green or the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876. This happens 3 years after a financial crisis in the U.S. where they wanted to expand because of the financial crisis and get more and more land. The Dawes Act, which I mentioned very briefly in 1887, this is one of the worst pieces of legislation for Native Americans. It systematically took the limited reservation land that existed and basically allotted it out to individuals and broke up collective ownership. And any surplus land that was left was given to settlers or were opened up to sale for settlers or corporations or what have you. This was a kind of capitalist consolidation of some sort. And so, to pivot just for 1 second, Israel and Palestine. I'm not going to get into depths of this, but one way I like to think about Palestine to Turtle Island is think about Jewish settlers are where the U.S. was in the mid-1800s, but with 21st century weapons. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, the amount of solidarity between settlers and Palestinians is not at the level that we see in the United States today. But it would be outrageous for, like I said before, for us to even think that settlers had any interest in indigenous liberation in the 1800s. The status of settlers have changed in the United States, in Israel, the status is one of privilege, is subsidized by the government, is protected by the army, just like in the United States was. So, going back to the book Empire Tracks, when he was talking about the process of capital being the driving force of settlement. This is an important piece. So, quote, "Land grants and the willful misreading of treaties as the real estate transaction, to paraphrase Vine Deloria, were central to the growth of the United States as a continental and then global imperial power, central to waging war at ever-grading scales. Lenin noted, the capital-exporting countries have divided the world among themselves in the figurative sense of the term, but finance capital has also led to the actual division of the world. Before this could happen in North America, finance capital led to the division of the continent itself, and the Transcontinental Railroad was a key instrument in that division." No, and settlers were tools of capital that was ultimately the system that benefited and drove settlement. And we have to remember that settlers themselves were from European countries, such as Germany, Norway, Sweden, Finland. Anyone who's in the upper Northwest knows those are the heritage of many of the people. And they had the protection of the United States based on their ideology of white supremacy. There were freed slaves that ventured out west to be settlers themselves, but faced vicious, vicious racism. And so we need to understand the complexities of that. And as I mentioned before, the face of settlers is very different today than it was in the past. Many settlers no longer have a material interest in the ideas of settler colonialism. More and more folks who are descendants of settlers are having their land taken away as well. We have seen the development of multiracial groups that are fighting the fossil fuel industry. Most recently, in the organization called the Cowboy Indian Alliance, or what happened at the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline. So Chief Phil Lane, who is Dakota and Chickasaw, reflected on some of the recent outrage of settlers' lands being taken. And Dina Gilio-Whittaker, who is Colville Confederated Tribes in Oregon, in her book, As Long as the Grass Grows, I kind of quoted him talking about this meeting. I'm sorry if I get emotional at the end of this. It's a good quote. So those ranchers came in and spoke to that council, and they shared their heart. So finally, we came back after the treaty signing. We had about 10 or 15 ranchers there. They all got up to speak. And one after another, they got up and they said, they're infuriated. They said, how could this happen? How can people take our land? How can they do this to us? And of course, we didn't see a smile, but everybody knew we was thinking about from our side. So finally, this last sister gets up to speak and she says, I am just so infuriated. They're coming and taking our land. They just can't do that without our consent. This is our land that our families have lived on in since, you know, how long they've been there. And said, they're treating us just like, and then one of the relatives said, just like the Indians. And all of the sudden, there was a beautiful pause and everyone was like, yes. And one of my relatives walked over and says, welcome to the tribe. Welcome to the tribe. So, as Marxists, we got to think about liberation. What are the roles of settlers today? What are the roles of multiracial fight back? So, as Marxists, we believe in the politics of solidarity. What we mean by that is not simply standing side by side with each other because it's the right thing to do or because it's nice, which is true, but that our struggles are connected. The politics of solidarity was on display at the fight at the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the examples of Standing Rock, Keystone XL, stand in the tradition of the Black Hills Alliance in the 1980s that brought together natives and non-natives in the Black Hills in South Dakota to try and stop uranium mining. And these struggles would not have been possible without a multiracial fight back that is connected to the struggle for land. Indigenous people must be acknowledged for their leadership in these struggles throughout the centuries and recent decades. It has been Indigenous people who have welcomed solidarity, who have every right to not welcome it. Inside these movements, activists have started to see their struggles linked together to fight for native self-determination and against ecological destruction, imperialism, colonization, and people's ideas have changed throughout these struggles, and we need to remember that. A whole new generation of activists at Standing Rock learned the long history of the U.S. continually breaking treaties with nations. How the U.S. stomps over self-determination anytime the U.S. government and corporations need access to native lands to extract energy and raw materials. The energy companies are the settlers today. The climate justice movement is coming to an understanding that treaties must be upheld and extended to demanded by indigenous nations for their traditional territories. And Standing Rock opened a fuller picture of Native oppression and struggles that go beyond just treaty rights and the racism that is felt, the poverty that it feels, the violence against women's reproductive justice, the separation of families, of indigenous families, who were the first people in this country to face separation, and the unequal access to quality education and healthcare and the effects of climate change. So we believe in a democratic world run by people. As Clay Thomas Mueller, who's of the Cree Nation and an Idle No More activist in Canada, said, imagine if the workers in the First Nations actually joined forces in a meaningful coalition, the rightful owners of the land side by side with the people working the mines and pipelines coming together and to demand another economic model. And we need to understand that Indigenous people are working in those mines and in those pipelines as well.
Yeah.
So Howard Adams, who's a Métis from the Métis Nation in Canada and a Marxist, ultimately put forward a vision of how a national liberation struggle along with broader class struggle could be achieved. He said, this oppression of the native people is so deeply rooted, and this is in the 1970s, just so people understand, is so deeply rooted in the capitalist system that it cannot be completely eliminated without capitalism itself. The Indian Métis struggle for self-determination against the ruling class have some potential because of the occupational structure of the native people. These Indians and Métis who have jobs are almost exclusively laborers, and very few are of the professional classes or the petty bourgeois. Because of racism, we are the most exploited and oppressed of all workers. At the moment, the success of Native movement depends on its ability to develop a radical thrust and upon the strength of its red nationalism. Mobilization of the masses of Indians and Métis is still centered around local community struggles. However, as the struggle widens, social class features will gradually become more prominent and the movement will turn into a class struggle. Indians and Métis will come to see that the different class struggles throughout Canada are not separate but related. And then he went on to say, the Indians and Métis movement must focus primarily on the destruction of imperialism and on the process of decolonization. There is no longer any question of where the native struggle should pursue a capitalist or socialist path of development. Liberation can take place only within a true socialist society. In the United States, we cannot separate capitalism from colonialism and imperialism, and its ideological components are necessary to uphold capital. And if we are to build a left that seeks to overturn the current order, we need to understand the role of settler colonialism and how it is still a dominating feature on Turtle Island. These individual settlers, i.e. white people, still have advantages to indigenous people on Turtle Island, but they materially no longer have an interest in that system that in the end does not benefit them. Settler colonialism is a system that must be overturned. And if we do not have a left that actually understands and puts the question of land, imperialism, and conquest at its center, we will perpetuate the same old song of class reductionism. Indigenous liberation is about liberation for all. We will not succeed in slowing, let alone stopping climate change, devastation, and having clean air, water, and land unless we stand for indigenous rights, sovereignty, and the enforcement of treaties. And great organizations like the Red Nation are leading this charge. And there's going to be a talk at 11:30 tomorrow, I strongly recommend people go, called the Original Red Scare. So settlers often say, if we give land back, they're going to do exactly what we did to them. And this is a very colonized mindset. Indigenous liberation is liberation for all. It's about changing our relationship to the land and labor and changing the profit system. And I would argue that a future decolonized Turtle Island is looking forward towards a social society that's put forward indigenous self-determination and liberation that counters racism, white supremacy, settler colonialism, imperialism, and capitalism. A society that is centered around indigenous and Marxist understanding of how democratic communal relationships and control of the earth is the only way for liberation for all.